Okay, good evening, everyone, including those at home. So our topic for tonight will be Roman anti-Semitism. This will be the last of the sessions that we do on the pre-Christian period. We're going to sum up attitudes of the Roman intellectuals and the Roman mob towards Jews and how that affected our people in antiquity. And then give a historical overview of the events. And then by the hour's end, we'll have finished the classical period. And next week, we'll turn to issues of Jesus and Paul and the origins of Christian anti-Judaism. Okay. So if we determined last time that anti-Semitism originated in the specific religio-political context of ancient Egypt, what then was the Greek contribution to everything? How did Greece, Hellenistic civilization, change what had been an originally Egyptian anti-Jewish sentiment? And the answer is that they added the elements of xenophobia and misanthropy, that other groups aside from the Jews were charged with xenolasia, expulsion of foreigners. The Spartans were accused of that. Many other barbarian groups were accused of that. However, only the Jews were accused of going from a practical matter of expelling outsiders, a reasonable proposition, so people thought, to the further proposition of a hatred of foreigners, not just that you get rid of them from your territory for convenient practical reasons, but that you hate them with a passion, and that you have an unsocial mode of life, and that you cannot interact with anyone other than your own kind. Well, having been so accused, the Jews then flipped the charge around and accused other people of the same thing. The Wisdom of Solomon, which is not a biblical book, but it's in a apocryphal book, a pseudepigraphic book, accuses the Egyptians of xenophobia for enslaving their guests. Hey, we were guests of Pharaoh in Egypt in the days of Joseph, and what did he do to us? He put us in bondage. Okay, he was a bigger xenophobe than we were. Josephus says that the sin of the Sodomites, Anshe Sodom, was that of xenophobia. Why does Josephus have this interpretation of that chapter of the Book of Bereshit? Why doesn't he say the big problem of Sodom was that they were going to engage in homosexual relations with Lot's guests, or that they were killers or cutthroats or thieves? Okay, so the answer is, by showing that the Bible speaks ill of xenophobes, it proves to the Greco-Romans that we, Jewish civilization, have been protesting against that sin from time immemorial. Meaning, you accuse us of that sin, we say no. Not only are we not guilty, but our holy book has taught us not to behave that way. We've been reading that holy book for 1,000 years. Okay. Now, misanthropy, the hatred of people, is related to misology, which is the hatred of logical arguments. Socrates once said, when without skill, one puts complete trust in somebody, thinking the man absolutely sound and true and reliable, and then a little while later finds that man to be bad and unreliable. And when that happens again and again with different persons, one ends up hating everyone, thinking there's no soundness in anyone at all. Meaning if you're bamboozled one time, a second time, like George Bush said, fool me twice, shame on somebody, shame on me. So if you get fooled time and again, you end up hating everyone, not trusting everyone. The misanthrope and the misologist suffer from the lack of skill to distinguish between good and bad people and good and bad arguments, and are forced by their ignorance to draw the most extreme but wrong conclusion, namely that there only are bad people and bad arguments. So what is this then when applied to the Jews? It's an accusation that we're a bunch of dummies, that we're easily fooled, and having been fooled too many times, we lash out by hating everyone.
How are we fooled?
So one of the ways that the later Roman writers will say Jews were fooled is by believing the Mosaic Code, by having accepted the yoke of the commandments on the basis of the say-so of some charlatan and having it adversely affect our lives without being a true divine revelation. But there are other ways that Jews were seen as naive or politically complacent when people didn't have their best interests at heart. So Philo, like Josephus would after him, lumps together misanthropy and xenophobia and says that it's not the Jews, but their accusers who are guilty of these sins. And Philo notes that not among the Jews, but among the Greeks and the Romans, a sacrilegious thing of infanticide was made commonplace. So here you're accusing us of hating people, but what are you doing? You're killing babies. You're hating people even more than we are. We have at least a heart. We don't do such a thing, but you guys do it. Okay. Now, accusations of these sins by Greeks against Jews gained traction during the Maccabean expansion, the time of Antiochus VII. We've mentioned Antiochus VII a few times before. One theory of anti-Semitism has it that the high point was in the late 2nd century and early 1st century BCE, and that at the time of political expansion and forced conversions, and that anti-Semitism was the poisonous fruit of the confrontation between Judaism and Hellenism. However, this theory isn't really right, because, yes, maybe anti-Semitism was repackaged at that time, but it dates back to a much earlier period of the indigenous Egyptians, like the Egyptian priest Manetho, who we spoke about a few weeks ago. So, yes, Egyptian anti-Semitism is the origin. It gets repackaged in Greek form with new arguments and new accusations. But then the Greeks give way to whom? To the Romans. So I want to spend tonight focusing on what did the Romans think about the Jews? We know they went to war several times, but the Jews started those wars. So that's a Jewish attitude of wanting freedom and would be willing to fight and die for a temple, for a commonwealth in Eretz Israel. But what is the Roman attitude towards the Jews? So the first evidence of Roman anti-Semitism is in the writings of Cicero. Cicero lived 106 to 143 before the Common Era. And he wrote about an episode where Flaccus, not Joe Flacco, but Flaccus, he put his hand in the cookie jar. He stole the machatzit ha-shekel. Whoa, it's a big sin. You know, the Jews are sending machatzit ha-shekel from all around the world by messenger to Jerusalem, to the Holy Temple, to fund the Korbanot. And what does Flaccus do? He confiscates the donations. So Cicero notes that Flaccus was arrested and tried and eventually convicted in Rome, in Imperial Rome. And the prosecutor was Laelius. And he accused Laelius of arranging the time and place of the trial so that the Jews of Rome could form a vocal pressure group and influence the trial. You can imagine like a scene where Jews are hanging from the rafters of the courtroom, banging and saying, he's guilty, 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 and that it was all a conspiracy to convict this man. So I'll read to you what is said about that trial. No. The Jews were definitely there. Okay, so it says like this. It was the practice each year to send gold to Jerusalem on the Jews' account from Italy and all of our provinces. But Flaccus issued an edict forbidding its export to Asia. Who is there, gentlemen, who cannot generally applaud this measure? So here Cicero is saying, Yasher koach! It's a good thing he stopped those machatzit ha-shekel. Why should the Jews take all their money and bring it to Israel? The gold should stay here in Italy. The Senate strictly forbade the export of gold of any considerable number on previous occasions, notably during my consulship. So it's illegal to send gold out of the country. Export laws, currency export laws. And the Jews were violating it. So Flaccus was right to confiscate it.
What year was this?
We're talking about in the 50s BCE.
So that's right about the time Caesar came in.
Around that time, yeah. So we're going to see it plays a role how the Jews were on the side of Caesar. To oppose this barbaric superstition was an act of firmness. And to defy in the public interest, the crowd of the Jews on that occasion sent our public meetings ablaze was the height of responsibility. So here he's yelling about the crowd of the Jews, the rabble of the Jews, that they are interfering with the public interest. The public interest was to stop the export of gold. And Flaccus did that. And he's being tried and prosecuted unfairly for having done a good job. And the crowd of Jews are getting in the way.
How important were the Jews? World situation.
So a lot more important than we might have given them credit for, and of growing importance because of a growing demographic, largely because of proselytism, not because of a high Jewish birth rate in the diaspora, at least not yet. Okay, so Cicero argues that it's in the public interest to defy the ever-growing influence of the Jews on public affairs. The crowd of the Jews and all the best men are very different groups. Notice he says all the best men is in contradistinction to the Jews. The Jews are the nachschleppers, the bad guys, the ones we don't like. But the best men, they're in the opposition. It was a political dispute between Cicero's optimates, who preferred a traditional conservative aristocratic senatorial control of society versus the populars. The populars were the party of Julius Caesar, which was ostensibly a populist party and which had Jewish support. So here it's like the Democrats versus the Republicans. Cicero's on one side of the aisle, the Jews are on the other. And so of course he's going to besmirch them. The Jews unfortunately found themselves on that wrong side of the aisle in this instance. Yet it's not just politics. The matter also had a religious flavor. Cicero thinks he's defending the values of Rome against a barbaric superstition. In his view, true religion is Roman religion. Jewish religion, Judaism, is but a mere Eastern superstition. And that dangerous superstition is infiltrating the heart of Rome. So Cicero says that Judaism is incompatible with Rome at the level of values, and that there was conflict even before there was nationalist conflict. This is an important point. It's one thing to say the Jews want freedom in Eretz Israel, the Romans have a large empire, they go to war over territory. That's all true. But Cicero is arguing even before the conflict over territory and over politics and over nationalism, there was an inherent contradiction between Jewish values and Roman values. Okay? And he fears that Jewish influence in Rome will be destructive and take down the glorious Roman civilization. Is this an exaggeration?
No.
No, it's not. Why not?
Because they were.
Because ultimately Christianity does, and Christianity is Judaism in the eyes of first and second century Romans. The chiluk, the distinction between the two, emerges at a later time. It's just an Eastern superstition with two different denominations. The answer to that question is that Judaism offers belief in a benevolent deity and offers concepts like sachar va'onesh, olam hazeh, olam haba, things that Roman paganism doesn't necessarily offer. Roman paganism isn't honest and fair and good. It has the gods upstairs that you have to placate, but they're not necessarily moral. So there were those who had a heightened sense of theology and or moral compass.
Based on economic reasons, because the Roman hierarchy lived in their own world, and the push left.
But there were people who converted to Judaism from all levels of Roman society, all economic levels. Okay.
I would assume that the Jews were not citizens, which makes a big difference.
They will become citizens in the year 212, in the days of Caracalla, but are not citizens just yet, at least not in most of...
another 260 years.
But some had high position, despite not the Jews on a whole not being citizens. Okay, so not all Latin writers were hostile to Jews. Varro, who was slightly older than Cicero, thought that Judaism was true religion and that Roman religion had fallen to the status of superstition. And we'll find that if you go through Menachem Stern's three-volume Greek and Latin writers on Jews and Judaism, about 60% of those statements in those three volumes are neutral about Jews. About 23% are hostile, about 18% are positive. So almost as many statements are positive about Jews as there are negative about Jews. It's not universal that the Roman intellectuals hate the Jews, but
the situation that's written in these books was objective, in that these were just comments giving impressions.
They're the impressions of the people who write things and who leave behind a written record and something for us to look at, a document, as opposed to the popular will, which leaves behind no documents, but we might be able to study what happened at the popular level, and we'll get to that tonight. Okay, now growing Jewish influence in Rome provoked even further dislike. The vanquished have given laws to the victors. And in the days of Domitian, between 81 and 95, the emperor realized that a lot of people are turning towards Judaism, and as I said, he made money off of it. He imposed the fiscus judaicus, the tax, which was the successor to the machatzit shekel, on anyone who evinced even the slightest bit of Judaizing, knowing that you could make bank on this phenomenon. And it was also a way of eliminating political rivals. If someone was on the wings and the sides of aristocratic life in Rome, but might have had an idea of taking over, you could always accuse them of atheism, which equals Judaism, and exile them, execute them, do whatever you like. And that's what happened to Flavius Clemens and Flavia Domitilla. So the virus, so to speak, was infecting the highest levels of society. Now, Juvenal, a name I've mentioned a few times before, was xenophobic. He didn't like Jews, but he also didn't like Greeks and Egyptians and foreigners generally. But the exclusiveness of the Jews was especially bothersome to him. If Greeks were blamed for integrating too much, Jews were blamed for integrating too little. Yeah, the Greek is not very, very well liked, but he's blending into Italian, Latin society in Rome. Whereas the Jew is there, but is not blending in. And for that, he's faulted. Okay?
Were the Jews the business people in there?
They were of all economic sorts. Now, Juvenal also accused the Jews, and only the Jews, of proselytism. He charged that one had to abandon the laws of Rome in order to follow Jewish law, which I think is not really true, but it was an accusation. And the Roman tinge on the charge of misanthropy was these people who adopt a life particularly alien and hostile to Roman culture succeed strangely and ominously in entering Roman society and converting Romans to their religion of arrogant exclusiveness. So this is like they couldn't understand it. How could it be that these Jews who are so standoffish and do not integrate nonetheless are capable of attracting adherents from our group to their group, who then join the club of standoffishness? Doesn't make sense. Yeah.
The tone of all of what you're speaking about is so different than what we spoke about in the last 2 weeks, where they were talking about court.
Yeah.
Here, they're not looking at any of the
rituals. Right, the ritual is not the issue. The ritual is, generally speaking, not the issue. What's at issue is blending in versus standing to the side, and more importantly even, the threat that the Roman civilization that these writers held dear would no longer exist because it would be overtaken by some foreign cult from the eastern lands. And they just didn't understand, they couldn't grasp the attraction. They knew it existed and they were dealing with the fallout from it, but they couldn't understand the attraction. Okay.
But this is more like the differentness of these two than it is about the Jewishness.
That's correct. It's not the Jewishness per se. It's the Now, Tacitus feared that a religion which in its exclusiveness was so contrary to cherished Roman values undermined and threatened to destroy them. He noted that Vespasian's siege of Jerusalem took longer than it had to because the Jewish fighters in their mountain citadel clung obstinately to their superstition. Now, in this instance, superstition doesn't mean like the mitzvahs of the Torah. It means more their nationalism, their crazed tenacity to fight to the death for the sake of their cause. That Tacitus is thinking to himself, they should have rolled over and died or given up the cause. After all, they were much weaker. We were much stronger. Why did it take so long to defeat them? Because of their obstinate superstition.
You're talking about 66 AD?
Yeah. Okay. Basically, he's saying they're crazy. Now, then Tacitus says that the Jews as a problem for the world was something that Antiochus IV could have resolved. That Antiochus could have solved the world's problem by getting rid of Jews and Judaism, not through genocidal means, but through changing the Jewish culture and having them blend into Hellenistic society. But he was prevented from doing so by circumstances, by his war with the Parthians. Now, that's a curious reinterpretation of what? Of the Hanukkah story. Really what happened was the Maccabees rebelled and they won. It's true Antiochus IV went off to fight the Persians in Parthia and died while away at battle, but that's not why the Jews did not become Hellenistic. The Jews did not become Hellenistic because a faction within them refused to be Mityavnim and held firm to their religious traditions. Okay, so Jewish superstition versus worldwide Greek civilization. And Tacitus is claiming that the Hasmoneans held power by suppressing the population and illegitimately merging the priesthood with the kingship. Mm-hmm. Who agrees with him? Chazal agree with him that merging the priesthood with the kingship was a sin of the Hasmoneans. So here a Roman historian is saying the same thing. Now, Jewish national superstition versus Roman national religion. Tacitus believed that Jewish hubris in refusing to follow along with Roman ways had the natural consequence of the destruction of the temple, meaning it was going to have to happen. If the Jews are not going to follow the religion of the world and hold on to their peculiar ways, it was inevitable the temple would be destroyed. Is that a reasonable interpretation of history? Well, you could argue that it is. I mean, if world civilization was coming to, you know, one, not instead of Hashem Echad or Shmo Echad, but rather, you know, Jupiter Echad or Jupiter Echad, then yes, if you're a holdout and you are at odds with everyone else, okay, but conflict always rises to the surface. Now, so yeah, the destruction failed to end Jewish national and religious ambition. Quite the contrary, it survived. And this was precisely Tacitus's problem. The Jews in Judaism should be dead, but they aren't. And it was infuriating. It was infuriating to him that despite political defeat and the demise of the Jewish Commonwealth in the land of Israel, that Judaism and the Jewish people still remain a force to be reckoned with on the world stage. Why? He can't get it. It doesn't make sense to him. Tacitus sees Judea as the country of the disease's country of origin. Christians are essentially Jews, only worse, as far as he's concerned. And Tacitus holds Jews responsible for Christian atrocities. So he lumps them together, says the Christians are the worst, but really blames the Jews for everything. That Christians had grown out of Judaism, and if the root were destroyed, the stock would perish. Meaning if you kill off Judaism, Christianity will die too. That's a peculiar understanding of the state of religious affairs in the world. But bear in mind when he's writing this, around the year 100, 110, 120, at that time, Christianity is still pretty small and relatively weak. And Judaism is significantly larger. So if you destroy Judaism, then the threat of Christianity also goes away.
But they were really after the Christians from the time of Nero.
Yes, they were brutally suppressing them. Just having the name Christian could get you thrown to the lions. Okay. Now, the Christians were the worst rascals among the Jews, as far as he was concerned. But the disease was not confined to Judea. It had infected the imperial capital itself, Rome. Other barbarians were terrible in the view of Tacitus, but none of them were as threatening as the Jews. He compared the aggravated anger directed, he had incomparable aggravated anger directed against the Jews. And he could not comprehend the paradox that Jews refused to be part of Roman civilization, yet they were successful at proselytizing. The danger was getting out of control as far as he was concerned. Now, Tacitus personified the palpable fear of the Roman upper class that Jews might succeed despite their political defeat. The growing appeal of Judaism in Roman society resulted in a backlash. Tension between appeal, fear, and hatred produced Judeophobia. Phobia in the sense of, I'm afraid of something. I may also hate it, but primarily I'm afraid of it. Circumcision interested the Greek writers as an historical matter in terms of the question of origins. But for Roman writers, as was noted, circumcision, it's not an issue of the mitzvahs that they're concerned about. Rather, it's that it's the last step towards conversion. And conversion means one more person joins the ranks of the Jews. And it's tipping the balance, a delicate balance, away from pagan dominance towards potential Jewish dominance. Okay. So proselytism is an issue in Roman literature, but not in Greek literature. And misanthropy is more of an issue in Greek literature and not in Roman literature. The Roman writers knew about Jewish exclusiveness, but it concerned them not as an essential character trait of the Jews, as the surprise that despite exclusiveness, Jews are winning over converts. So it's not so much that Jews are inherently standoffish, it's that, but they are standoffish, and they're winning, and they're getting people to their team. Greek writers write about Jews doing human sacrifice. Roman writers don't. Why? Because on the whole, the Roman writers knew more about Jews. Remember, it's later in history, and the later you are in history, the more facts come out. some of the Greek writers were writing too soon. They really didn't know anything about Judaism. Bits and pieces, fragmentary knowledge, whereas the Roman writers had more substantial knowledge. The Jews were no longer a mystery like they had been to Westerners during the Hellenistic period. So the Roman attitude is much more complex than the Greek or Egyptian attitude had been. The Romans inherited some negative baggage, but it morphed. There's contempt, but also respect, and fear that the respectable elements of Judaism will yield a flood of converts. Now, it's insufficient to say that there was no anti-Semitism in the ancient world because the ancients lacked the notion of race. That's a facile argument. To say, well, because race is a modern concept, you couldn't have anti-Semitism in yesteryear. No, baloney. You could definitely have anti-Semitism. But how do we define the transition between anti-Judaism or some anti-Jewish sentiment and what we want to comfortably call anti-Semitism? So one of the scholars, Gavin Langmuir, had a theory about how you get to anti-Semitism. And it has three levels. The first level is realistic hostility. Realistic hostility is when both the in-group and the out-group share the same assumptions. They're competing for scarce goods and resources. And there's nothing specifically anti-Jewish about it, meaning I don't like you and you don't like me. I say I have a certain character trait and think it's a good thing. You say I have the very same character trait, but you find it repulsive. So you don't like me, but you don't like me for reasonable reasons. You're not making up stuff that's defamatory or false. It's just that we have different values. We're in competition. What to me is good to you is bad, therefore you don't like it. So that's not yet anti-Semitism. Stage two is...
By the way, this particular realm described, where is that manifest?
Oh, so it's...
International and national debate with Islam.
So in the theological realm, it's not at all relevant, because in the theological realm, it's just a matter of beliefs about the divine, and maybe, you know, what some holy book says, negative or positive about some other group. You know, the Torah says we don't like Amalek. Whereas this is talking about, put the holy books aside. What is the gut feeling towards that other group, towards the person who's a member of that other group? And how do you assess them? So stage one is, we're on the same wavelength. We just don't like each other. What I think is good, you think is bad, and vice versa. The second stage is xenophobia. Xenophobia is where you impute to all members of the other group something that really only manifests itself in a fringe minority of that other group. So, for example, there's a kernel of truth to it. The Jews are Christ killers. That's xenophobia in the sense that, yeah, the Sanhedrin may have called for Jesus' execution. So some Jews really were involved in his death, maybe. But what do you say? All Jews are Christ killers. That, stage two, xenophobia. Stage three is the chimera, where it's not even true at all. Jews have horns, or Jews poison the wells, or Jews get blood from a kid for matzah. It never happened. But yet, some people believe it happened. And it's imputed to all Jews, despite not just being with some, it's being with no Jews.
But economics doesn't come into any.
Oh, it sure does. Why does such a chimera come to exist? Because you want to plunder them or whatever. There's always some economic motivation to have an outright lie. Sometimes there's a theological motivation too, but usually it's an economic motivation. So according to Langmuir,
isn't that manifest? Theological debate down through the ages, not just that particular.
Yeah, you could apply it to other centuries as well. Correct. Now, according to Langmuir, stage three is needed for something to be called anti-Semitism. And in his view, it's only reached in the year 1150 when charges of host desecration, ritual murder, well poisonings, and the like become commonplace. So, 12th century. Correct. The era of the Crusades. But and at that time, Jews did not have power to demonstrate the falsity of these accusations. So Langmuir would claim that Greek, Roman, and Persian hatred of Jews was still in the category of realistic hostility. But by contrast, early Christian anti-Judaism was in category two of xenophobic assertions. Christians felt their identity threatened by Jews. So think about it. In this version of the story, stage one, realistic hostility, is Persian, Greek, Roman. Stage two, xenophobia, is early Christian. And stage three, full-blown anti-Semitism, is medieval Christian, Crusader era. Now, Peter Schaeffer in Judeophobia, one of the best books on this subject, says that Lanier's theory is all wrong, and his distinctions are artificial. Okay? The Jews were regarded as threats to society already back in Egyptian times, at Elephantine, in Greek society, and in the Roman context. And from the very beginning, animus was directed at Jews, regardless of what Jews actually do or don't do. So there are phony baloney stories about donkey worship and this and that, and eating a Greek and fattening him up and slaughtering him. Okay, all that stuff was around in the classical period. Chimerical assertions were around, you know, way before the Crusader period. Yeah, so phenomenologically, they're no different than the idea of killing Christian children for baking matzah. Thus, even according to Lamier's own model, if not his own interpretation, anti-Semitism predates Christianity. His model does not help to distinguish between anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism. There's no clear-cut point where one gives way to the other. So, if we can reject that theory, let's go to Shia Cohn. Shia Cohn asks, where is this elusive point that separates justifiable hatred from unjustifiable hatred? Where does anti-Judaism become anti-Semitism? And so I'll read to you what he says about Apion and Hadrian. This is Shia Cohn speaking. So, regarding Apion and Hadrian, the former had good reason to dislike the Jews and to oppose their attempts to obtain civic equality. And the latter had good reason to suppress a Jewish rebellion and to forbid the practice of Judaism. Here, Shia Cohn, a man with smicha and a PhD and a professor of Jewish studies, is saying, yeah, they had a good reason to hate the Jews. Okay, but he's not an anti-Jew. He's just saying these men of yesteryear had their reasons to dislike Jews. But would Apion's policies have led to the creation of a Jewish ghetto, the profanation of Jewish synagogues, the looting of Jewish property, and anti-Jewish pogroms, had these policies not been motivated, at least in part, by hatred of Jews and Judaism? Would Hadrian's suppression of a rebellion have led to a three-year persecution of Judaism and the deaths of numerous martyrs, including the Asar Harugei Malchus, had it not been motivated, at least in part, by hatred of Jews and Judaism? I indicated in the previous paragraph that the simple application of the term anti-Semitic to these instances is neither justifiable nor helpful. But here I concede, says Shia Cohn, perhaps we must allow for a certain degree of anti-Semitic feeling to account for the scale and severity of the incidents. Both Apion and Hadrian crossed the point that separates justifiable from unjustifiable, but the precise location of this point is as elusive for historians of antiquity as it is for students of contemporary anti-Semitism. Basically, he throws in the towel and says, I can't tell you where the dividing line is. All I know is that there is a dividing line, and those guys crossed it. But they had reason to dislike Jews, and they had reason to try to suppress Jewish political aspirations. But they took it too far. They killed a lot of people. They abolished, you know, Hadrian abolished Judaism for 3 years. At some point, they took it too far. So Schaeffer says that Shia Cohn's interpretation introduces a dangerous and easily misunderstood quantitative element. That somewhere along the way, there's a scale of 1 to 10. And if you get past the 7.5, already that's too much. Like they say, who's an anti-Semite? Someone who hates Jews more than they have to. I think Winston Churchill said that. He's a JTS guy. At Harvard and Brown. Okay. So Schaeffer argues that the jump from anti-Judaism to anti-Semitism is when Jews are made out to be the evil incarnate, where they are identified as the outcasts of human civilization. And, quote, only the idea of a worldwide Greco-Hellenic civilization made it possible for the phenomenon we call anti-Semitism to emerge. Meaning, it has to be that you think, you the anti-Semite, who doesn't like the Jews, regard the whole world as one human family and one cultural style or type, and that those holdouts, the Jews, are the only ones who are preventing kumbaya, all the world, all of humanity being like-minded. Well, is the world really all that like-minded? No. I mean, were the Mongolians Hellenic? No. Were the Koreans Hellenic? No, but they didn't know them, okay? So when you're very self-centered and you think you're the be-all and end-all and your civilization, your culture is the highest culture, and you've imposed your will and cultural conformity on anyone who's in your realm, except one obstinate or stubborn group, then and only then can you have the kind of thing we call anti-Semitism. That's the argument that's being made here. That they could dislike a lot of other groups, but those other groups might have fallen, you know, into line and gotten with the program. But the Jews aren't getting with the program. And the only ones, therefore, we have special animus towards.
But it seems to be very pronounced because the Roman Empire covered Western Europe, the whole known world.
The whole known world, yes.
So they're the only ones in the whole known world that wasn't Romanized, according to what?
Yes, yes. Now, for Schaefer, it's enough for you to reach stage two. You don't need a chimerical assertions. It's enough to have xenophobia in order for it to be anti-Semitic. And that the episode in Alexandria, which we spoke about last time, was anti-Semitic because it was built upon pre-existing anti-Semitic disposition, meaning that they killed a lot of people on the basis of a fight over civil rights. Well, if there wasn't an existing ill will, an animus, then would the mob have killed that many people? No, certainly not. A political fight would not have been as bloody and as murderous without existing hostility and hatred. So the dual loyalty charge in the Egyptian Greek city plays a role. The political and culturally religious elements of anti-Semitism cannot then be separated. They're intertwined. Yeah, you don't like Jews because they're culturally and religiously different, and you don't like Jews because they're looking for and they're striving for civic equality, or even more than civic equality. When you put the two together, it's a lethal brew. However, the episode at Elephantine, according to Schaefer, would not be called anti-Semitic. It was still missing the Greek retelling of the story to jump beyond anti-Judaism, meaning it's just a fight between Egyptian priests and Jewish priests. Okay. Now, the accusation of misanthropy, which is key to the emergence of anti-Semitism, dates back to 300 years BCE and the Greek priests. Greek Esther, the Greek translation of Esther, the book of Esther, the Megillah, the Septuagint, emphasizes Jewish misanthropy in quoting Ahasuerus's anti-Jewish decrees. The Hebrew Esther, meaning our Megillah's Esther, is quite moderate. It says that the Jews have their own laws, but that the Ham should not be kolam. So the Greek Esther says far more. It says the Jews are a hostile people, opposing their laws to other people, in constant military awareness, against everyone, ill-disposed to our affairs, worst evil deeds, really besmirches them in a big way. Only when all the threatening Jews have been exterminated can the Persian Empire, and indeed all of humanity, be saved. That's the line that Haman is trying to tell Ahasuerus in the Greek version of Esther. So, according to Josephus, Haman tells Ahasuerus, the Jews are the enemy of your people and of all mankind. That is not in our Megillah. Why is it not in our Megillah? Because our Megillah is written earlier in an environment where the accusation of misanthropy doesn't exist. But the Greek translation is in a totally different cultural milieu and is responding to what they knew anti-Semites to be saying. So they put in the mouth of Haman and Ahasuerus what the anti-Semites of their own generation would have said about them. That's a key point. Okay. Now.
That's something that lives in our literature?
No. The Greek Esther is something only for academic scholars to look at once in a while, but the Jews are not reading Greek Esther. However, there is some overlap between Greek Esther and the Midrashim, including what appears in the Bavli in Masechta Megillah. And I wrote about this one time. It says in Megillah, in Masechta Megillah, that Esther ate what? Kosher. And it says in Masechta Megillah that Esther didn't work on Shabbos and had seven different employees, one each day of the week, so that nobody should know that she was keeping the Sabbath. So where do they get that from? It's also in the Greek Esther. This notion of making it more religious, because Esther is a very secular work. What's it doing in the Bible? She marries a Shagetz, and nobody's doing any mitzvahs. Nobody's keeping kosher in Shabbos. There's no religion. There's no Judaism in Esther. So the Gemara and the Greek translation introduce religion to make it more kosher. Okay.
Why would the Greek translation want to make it more
kosher? Oh, because it was written by Jews.
Oh, okay.
So
I'll wait for the Austral edition.
Okay. Now, Greco-Egyptian and Greek writers turned Jewish separateness into a monstrous conspiracy against humankind and a value shared by all of human civilization. Tacitus has an ambivalence between dislike and fear, criticism and respect, attraction and revulsion. He draws a distinction between barbarians and the Jews. Others might be savages and do loathsome things, but they would never be the kind of danger that the Jews were. So the Roman attitude of Judeophobia was well-founded. The vanquished did give laws to the victor in the sense that Christianity eventually does overtake pagan Rome. Now, in the time we have left, I want to discuss distinctions between governmental anti-Semitism, popular anti-Semitism, and intellectual anti-Semitism. And with this, we'll finish the whole time frame. So governmental anti-Semitism, let's be perfectly clear that there was hardly any other for many centuries. The Persians had a policy of toleration. Why? Well, first of all, they were a minority, a demographic minority in their own realm. So Cyrus's declaration, you know, that everyone can go back to build their temple, you know, V'ya'al, the last word of the Bible, Hebrew Bible, they can go up on Aliyah. So that's because, in general, the Persians were quite tolerant. Alexander, followed by the Ptolemies in Egypt, used the Jews as middlemen to help preserve their rule over the natives. So there was a vertical alliance between the Jews and their Hellenistic and later Roman overlords. Antiochus III, the Seleucid, gave the Jews special privileges and funded the temple. The Romans could not afford to antagonize the Jews, who were close to 10% of the total population of the empire and 20% of the population in the eastern provinces. There's a lot of Jews in the world. They were a substantial percentage of the overall population. Julius Caesar was grateful to the Jews for assistance rendered, and relations between Jews and Roman authorities were on the whole pretty good. They had their bad moments, but those moments were generally short-lived. What were some of those moments? We've mentioned in passing some of those. For example, in 139 BCE, the Jewish community of Rome was expelled, presumably because of missionary activity. In 19 CE...
Missionary activity.
So in 19 CE, there was the expulsion, if not of the whole community, then at least of proselytes, about 4,000 of them. But that was merely a temporary banishment. The Jewish community of Rome grew again quite quickly. And the Gemara talks about, you know, Todos ish Romi, Hinnigus b'nei Romi, lochol gedimukulis b'erev Pesach, that they used to have the helmeted goat on the night of the Seder, you know, the phony Korban Pesach. Jewish influence in Rome remained strong, so that even after the failed rebellion of 66 to 70, the Great Revolt, toleration was not rescinded. Prominent Jews after 70 CE included Agrippa II, Berenice, who was what? The girlfriend of Titus, and Josephus, who was on the payroll of the Flavian dynasty. So even though there was a war, you could still be a Jew and a prominent Jew on cozy terms with the Roman administration. The diaspora revolt did not lead to an end to the toleration, and even the Hadrianic decrees of the 130s were quickly overturned by his successor, Antoninus Pius. So it's true, only the Jews revolted three times, in 66 to 70, 115 to 117, 132 to 135. No other subgroup of the empire, no other conquered nationality revolted as many times as the Jews did. Yet still... I understand, but other people could have felt the same way they just did. Okay, so and yet the vertical alliance was still in place. Governmental anti-Semitism was not a major factor in the ancient world. And when I say the vertical alliance, that's to distinguish it between a horizontal alliance. What would a horizontal alliance be?
From a kingdom to another kingdom.
Where the Jews, together with some other ethnic minority, collaborate in going after the big bosses of the Seleucids, the Ptolemies, or the Romans. That doesn't happen. That did happen in First Temple times, at the end of the First Temple period, when Jews looked to the Assyrians or Jews looked to the Egyptians to find succor against the Romans, the Babylonians, and the prophets all rail against it and say, don't turn to this group or that group. You have to just have Emunah and Hashem. Okay, so those kind of horizontal alliances had a history. but not in the period we're talking about. There was a vertical one. The Jews recognized they're a defeated people, and they have to cozy up to the big bosses and not make common cause with the other, you know, ethnic minorities. And in fact, the relationship with the other ethnic minorities was bad. Jews did not get along with the indigenous Egyptians. The Jews did not get along with the Greeks under the Roman rule. Okay, now let's go to popular anti-Semitism. If governmental anti-Semitism was not much of a factor, except for in certain key moments during wars, what about popular anti-Semitism? So the answer is, there was a widespread fear and hatred of the Jew in the ancient world. The savagery of the mob at Alexandria speaks to a pent-up fury. Jews were accused of dual loyalty, of having a state within a state. And international Jewish power was blamed for Flaccus's recall. Now remember, the story of Flaccus, okay, and stealing the Machtis HaShekel, and him being sent to Rome for prosecution. So the idea of international Jewish power is what's behind the scenes of the prosecution of a government official who acted against them. Who used to speak of international Jewish power?
I'm talking about the Protocol of the Elders of Zion.
So Protocols of the Elders of Zion, yes, but even Hitler himself, he would speak of international Jewish finance. That was a common expression, especially in his speech from January 30th, 1939, one of his famous speeches, that international Jewish finance will precipitate another world war. Okay. Now, the mob at Alexandria.
That was a communist line.
Yes.
World War II.
Sure.
That was their dominant role for the next half century.
International Jewish finance.
But didn't you have that in the end of the 19th century with the anti-Semitic political parties and things like that?
Yeah, so anti-Semitic political parties in late 19th century had their focus on rescinding recently achieved political emancipation for the Jews in Central European countries. Now, their accusations were manifold, but one of them was that Jewish banking interests had enabled the Jews to achieve the kind of political clout and civic rights that they never should have achieved and should be rolled back.
It's true.
Okay. It's true. All right. Now,
the Goyim chased us away only to be bankers and then to get back.
Okay. Now, the mob at Alexandria killed Jews in 66 when the revolt broke out. So when war happens between the Jews of Eretz Yisrael and the Roman government, the mob in other parts of the Roman Empire take advantage of the fact that the government is, in the moment, not interested in protecting the Jews. And the absence of governmental protection means you're a sitting duck. And when you're a sitting duck and the neighboring Goyim don't like you, they're going to kill. All right? So they killed many. Tiberius Julius Alexander, who was an apostate Jew, one of the most famous apostate Jews of that period, killed 50,000 Jews in an attempt to quell the riots. Clearly, the Jews fought back. They were not just taking this lightly. They tried to fight back, but they didn't have the kofetz. The Gentile inhabitants of Ashkelon, which was the border, that's a lot of people. It's a lot of people. Yes, the Gentile inhabitants of Ashkelon, which is on the border of Judea and the Philistine coast, killed 2,500 Jews at the start of the war. Again, the government no longer protects you, so the mob is enraged. They'll do what they always wanted to do. Nero gave control of Caesarea to the Greeks in the year 66, indicating a breakdown in the vertical alliance. Rome was no longer an honest broker. So no longer having governmental protection, what did the Goyim of Caesarea do? They killed 20,000 Jews in 1 hour. So the Gentiles feared the growing number of Jews. They hated the proselytism and the Jewish quest for civic rights and wanted to plunder Jewish property. So those are the three things: issues of religious faith and people changing teams, proselytism, issues of changing the balance of who has what rights. And thirdly, I want your property. I have a lo tachmor, a beit reyecha. Well, I want it. So I'm going to take it. But after the war, the Roman authorities did whatever they could to restore order, that the Pax Romana had to be maintained. That, yeah, you can plunder the Jews and do bad things to them when there's an active conflict, on the battlefield, but when it's over, we have to get back down to ordinary behavior. And nobody can, be cutting throats in peacetime. The bitterness of the mob and governmental protectiveness are the two themes. In Rome, the mob never carried out a pogrom. Why not? Why in Rome did it never happen?
Seat of the government.
So the seat of the government, good. The seat of the government means that there are bodyguards protecting the emperor. It means that, you know, you have a lot of heavy-duty security, National Guard troops, okay? You don't want to have, if you're the government, vildachayas of any variety, of any ethnic variety, running around the imperial capital doing illegal things, because that can get out of control and result in the overthrow of the government. So it never got too feisty with the rabble in Rome. Now, as for intellectual anti-Semitism, which is what we've been mostly talking about the last few weeks, the Jews had their admirers. And as I mentioned, there were almost an equal number of positive statements as negative statements among the classical writers. The main themes of among the intellectuals were that the Jews have a hatred of mankind, that the Gentiles thought in part, why did this theory of the hatred of mankind develop? In part because the Gentiles did not have access to the Torah. And so they assumed the worst about a mystery cult. The thinking is, if I can't read it, it must be you're hiding something. What is it you're hiding? That you hate us all. Had they learned more, had they had access to the scriptures and to the Jewish religious tradition, they might have understood that it's not really the case.
That seems paradoxical, because you did have the translation from the Greek by this time.
Understood, but not everybody was reading it, and not everybody cared to read it. It's not a question just of access. It's a question of interest. Am I going to bother to do that?
Property, they don't care, they'll need to read anything else. No, that's true. Okay.
Now, the second issue is mocking the Jews for their credulity. They'll believe anything. They're a bunch of fools, as I mentioned before, with mythology and Socrates. The third thing is Jews as beggars. The Jews were portrayed as poor schnooks. Not everybody was. There certainly were wealthy Jews, and there were people who converted to Judaism who were in the high ranks of society. But this idea of the Jewish beggar was a common notion among the intellectuals in Rome. Were there Jewish beggars in Rome? You betcha, there certainly were. And Jews as a beleaguered people oftentimes suffered financial setbacks, economic setbacks in Eretz Israel and elsewhere. And yeah, you had Jewish beggars. The fourth thing is dual loyalty, the sending of money to Jerusalem. It really did bother them. This idea that, you know, you live here, but you send money there. For the pagan, your local place of worship is where you're going to worship, and you're going to worship the local deity. The idea that you're going to worship some deity of a foreign country and send your precious resources to that other country, it didn't strike them the right way. Today, we have more of an appreciation, even like in Gentile America, the notion that Jews have an affinity for the state of Israel, or that Jews will have charities that help Jews in other countries. But yeah, the worst anti-Semites will criticize that. But on the whole, people understand that you help your ethnic kinsmen, you help your co-religionists. That was not the case in Greek in Roman times. Yeah. Now, and the last thing was the aggressive proselytism. So one of the things that Louis Feldman of blessed memory said was that the reason why Roman writers thought that you had to cut ties with your family if you convert to Judaism was because of the halachic notion of ger shit gayer kikatan shenolad dami, that a person who converts to Judaism is like a newborn child, and halachically you have no relatives. That in theory midoraisa, if you would have an incestuous relation with your immediate relative, it's not arayas because you're not really related to them anymore. Now, but the rabbanon it's usher, it would be pretty gross, but this halachic concept does exist. And so Feldman theorizes that it was bastardized into, oh, you have to cut all ties with your family. It wasn't really true. Now, the lack of communication between intellectuals and the mob can help explain why the blood libel, which was already around in ancient times, did not lead to pogroms until medieval times. It's an interesting question. If they believe that Jews were fattening up a Greek to slaughter him and eat him in cannibalistic style, or to offer him a mizbeach in the Beis HaMikdash, then why did you not have crusade-type pogroms 2,100 years ago as you did 900 years ago? Why did it not happen? And so the theory is that the intellectuals who threw around these ideas, these calumnies, never were read by the masses who could have carried out a pogrom. There was just a disconnect between intellectual anti-Semitism and the mob had its other agenda of just plunder.
But can we beat it the fact that you get apostates and all these basically Jews who went the other way were the worst enemies?
Well, that's correct. Some of the worst enemies were people who were born Jews, whether it's Tiberius Alexander, yeah. Torquemada, whomever. Also, the government restrained the masses from violent outbreaks. And that's a difference between 2,100 years ago or 2,000 years ago on the one hand and 900 years ago on the other, that the absence of government restraint in the medieval period is what allows for Jews of spireworms and minds to be killed, as opposed to Roman governmental interference in staying the hand of the mob. Now, the masses had a love-hate relationship with the Jews. Mostly hate, a little bit of love. For those who had the love, they converted or became God-fearers. For those who had the hate, they couldn't understand why other people became God-fearers. And they just could not fathom it, could not tolerate it. But to conclude, Shaya Kona argues that it was anti-Judaism in the old days, not anti-Semitism, whereas Schaeffer says it was anti-Semitism. Now, the difference between the Greeks and the barbarians was between the Greeks on the one hand and barbarians and the Jews on the other was not racial or ethnic. It was cultural snobbery. That's what Shaya Kona says. Because it wasn't racial, it was not genetic. It was a Greek is someone who has Greek culture. Who's a barbarian? Could be the guy's brother, but he's an Amoret, he's a boor. So cultural snobbery is what distinguishes between the elite and the barbarian. Not my skin tone, not my physiognomy, not my facial features. So because it's not that, it's not racism, it's not anti-Semitism to Schaeffer, it's only anti-Judaism. And he concludes that to study anti-Judaism without acknowledging the attraction of Judaism is lachrymose indeed. That's how he ends his chapter in one of the books on classical anti-Semitism. It's lachrymose indeed. Now with this, I'll stop. But who is he referring to when he uses the word lachrymose? Who knows?
Crying, man.
So lachrymose is Salo Barone's criticism of Heinrich Goetz. Heinrich Goetz was the great Jewish historian in Germany in the 19th century. Died 1891. He wrote the History of the Jews. You probably have it on your shelves at home, 6 volumes, JPS 1891. It's a collector's item. So it's worth good money. So Goetz wrote a History of the Jews, which was all about suffering and learning and scholarship. And Salo Barone, who wrote the Social and Religious History of the Jews in the 20th century, he wanted to get away from the lachrymose history. He said, our past is not just about the Goyim persecuting us and us studying Torah. There's more to it than that. We had a whole culture, a whole civilization. There were positive moments. There were ups, there were downs. And so he tried to give a fuller picture. And so what Cohen is saying is, if you're going to study the past and only focus on the anti-Judaism, but not realize that there's also the attraction of Judaism that led to a lot of proselytes and some favorable attitudes, then you have a lachrymose approach to the whole thing. Don't take that approach. Understand the good and the bad. So we'll stop here.
Yeah. Couldn't that be the Christianity that came out?
Well, some of them never converted fully. They became Christian because that was their step. Okay, so we'll stop here. Next week is Kristallnacht. So to mark Kristallnacht 83rd anniversary, we're going to spend the session discussing rabbinic attitudes of Esav Sone Es Yaakov. What are the origins of that expression? Who believed it among our people? Who might not have believed it? And how it affected popular Jewish attitudes towards the outside world. So we'll see you next week.